Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. I'm Michael Steele and I'm exhausted. I don't know about you, but I am flat like whip. I'm like, you know, curl up on the couch, put a blanket over my head, stick an IV in my arm and call me in 4 weeks, kind of whipped. But we're still here. We're blessed. The election is over, but not over. And we'll get into that a little bit. But in the meantime, you know how I love you guys so much. When you do that, download Voodoo. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your download on. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele, all that good stuff. So let's get into it. It's crazy as hell out there right now. And I don't know how to parse it out, but I know someone who does, or at least has had a hand in reshaping the political landscape over the past couple of years. She is the co-founder, one of the co-founders of the Lincoln Project, a communication strategist consultant. She served as chair, and she's right up my alley here. She was the chairwoman of the New Hampshire Republican Party from 2013 to 2017, and was the 2008 New Hampshire 2nd Congressional District candidate nominee for Congress. She served as co-chair of the New Hampshire Log Cabin Republicans and sat on the Log Cabin Republicans National Board of Directors. I think that may have been the first time I really kind of got to know Jennifer, because I worked a lot with the log cabins when I was in D.C. and in Maryland. She was an award-winning radio talk show host and is currently a columnist for the New Hampshire Union Leader. She is none other than the incomparable Jennifer Horn. It is such a treat to have you on the podcast instead of hang out in the hood with me here. And so before we came on air, folks, Jennifer and I were laughing about how we look at campaigns as the old campaign hands. And it's like, are you tired? No, are you tired? And we're both exhausted. So are you tired?
While you're waiting for them to renew your IV, I feel like I've spent the last week trying to do all my meetings and phone calls from under the covers. You know, I don't even want to get out of bed in the morning. I'm curled up and I've got the blanket over my head. And I'm tired. I mean, this president has gone out of his way to make sure that we are all as exhausted as possible. And campaigns are always tiring, but I've come to believe that that's one of Donald Trump's intentional strategic efforts. Like, yeah, if we can exhaust the nation, we'll all just want to roll over and go back to bed and ignore him and let him get away with just a little bit more.
Yeah, and I think that's not the way. And look, I have to tell you, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of and I would just want to get this up front in this conversation, because Jennifer knows how I feel about it. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, the impact of Lincoln Project and all of that, and it's phenomenal. But a real big part of that Lincoln Project story is what this woman did in pulling together and corralling the boys into a cohesive fighting unit, from communications to media to now engaging in the legal space, which we'll talk about in a moment, but again, through communications and media. How did that come about for you? What was that animating moment for you, Jennifer, where you just said, F it, I'm done. This is, something's got to get done differently here. We cannot leave our country in the hands of a madman.
Well, I'll be honest, I've been publicly opposed to the idea of Donald Trump since 2011. I don't know if you remember, Michael, he came up, Trump came up to New Hampshire during the beginning of the 2012 cycle and kind of dipped his toes in the water. And I like to say Mitt Romney scared him off that year.
Right.
But I wrote an op-ed about him then when he first started looking at it and warned that if the Republican Party took him seriously, they would pay the price for it. And we've seen very much, I think, in a very real way that they have. So even when I was chairman during the 2016 cycle, you know, I never took sides. It was not my job to take sides for a candidate. But throughout that cycle, I was repeatedly asked questions about, you know, these horrific things that Trump had said or done. And in each one of those moments, I had to decide, was I going to defend the principles of the party or was I going to defend a politician? And every time I defended the principles of the party. Right. So I've been on the record, you know, about my, you know, feelings about Trump for a long time. As the Lincoln Project came together late last year, you know, I got a call from John Weaver. We were, all of us in the Lincoln Project are folks who had been kind of, you know, jogging along on our own path
right.
for the last 3 years, trying to make our voices heard, trying to get through to other members of our party, trying to, you know, each in our own way, trying to be that messenger. And so the end of last year, we kind of all came together. And that's when, you know, John and Reed and Rick and Steve Schmidt, they had this vision. They had this idea that like they're the ones really who sort of, you know, the concept of the Lincoln Project was theirs. And they reached out to the others of us and, you know, asked us in. And that was when it kind of all came together, where everybody bringing their own individual experience and talent and professionalism to it. And that's when it started to really gel. And we felt like we might actually be able to do something here where we could defeat Donald Trump.
Well, you did. And it's been a lot of fun for me. You know, I came in the door late in the game and you know, for the record, at the
love having you, Michael,
at the extended you're hand of one Jennifer great. Horn, by the way, to serve as a senior advisor on this effort. But it did have an impact. There's no doubt about it. I've seen it. I've heard it from a number of folks, even Republicans begrudgingly acknowledge the impact. Some other Republicans quietly applaud the impact. But the impact was real and it was a big part of sort of creating the narrative for this election, which is important when you're dealing with a guy who only knows media.
Right.
The guy who is a Hollywood wannabe who was pissed off that he never got the Emmy or whatever, or for his TV show, as well as someone who created a genre in media, reality TV, effectively. You did it the right way. You cut right to the bone of him. I mean, you didn't treat him like he was George Bush.
Right.
Or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama.
He doesn't act like George Bush or Bill Clinton, right?
Yeah. Right. So and that's always been one of my pet peeves in the last two year saga is how much the media and the political establishment it kept on trying to treat this man as if he was. Yeah. Now I'll say this and everybody understand, hopefully you understand what I mean. Treat him as a real president. He was a fake president. Yes, he was. I'm not taking away from the election. I got all that. But I'm saying in how you carry out the office
is
whether or not you do it seriously with the temperament and demeanor of a president, or you do it as if, okay, this is a role I'm playing. I'm going to play it the way I interpret it, not the way it has been played in the past. So a lot of folks just kept thinking, well, today he'll be president on this issue. Right. He'll sound and act more like a president. And a lot of us are sitting there going, no, he won't.
No, why? He won't. Why do you think that? Why do you believe he will?
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, when you look back through history, yes, Donald Trump was legitimately elected president. That's not the debate.
That's not the point. Right. Part
of the argument. When people have, and up until now, I mean, it's when men have, and that's a separate issue you and I can talk about another day,
right.
Every time a person has been elected president, they've come to the White House and they've stepped into the office, mm-hmm. and they've stepped up. Have I thought they were all great presidents? No. Have I agreed with all of them, Republican, Democrat? No. But they have become president. They get those briefings. They understand what's happening in the world. They understand the gravity of the role, and they step into it. Donald Trump chose to never step into that role. You know, he from the beginning chose to be Donald Trump rather than President Trump. So, and the American people have genuinely suffered as a result of that. Now, it's a very complex field that we were playing on in this election. I think that the press was to some degree concerned about the way in which they contributed to giving him credibility during his first campaign when they should not have, perhaps.
Right.
And as a result, were overly cautious in the way that they treated him. I think they were also trying to be journalistically fair, that he is the president, and
right.
all
right.
these sorts of things. But as we came into this campaign, we understood we had a couple of priorities at the Lincoln Project that we knew that if we took this approach, that we could be effective. The first was, our first thing was that we wanted to give other Republicans across the country permission to be against the Republican incumbent. So we felt like if we were loud and aggressive and put ourselves out there as Republicans and former Republicans, people would understand that this idea of loyalty to party over common sense and
right.
patriotism, you know, that they could set that aside. And that's when that was from the beginning, but you and I, as I was building this sub coalition of Republicans and independents for Biden, you know, as we were able to start bringing in respected Republican leaders like yourself, that expanded that opportunity mm-hmm. for us. But the other side of it, and this is where, you know, the evil genius of Steve Schmidt and Reid Galen and right. Wilson comes to play. You know, from the beginning, they always talk about the three prongs of this effort. One of them was what they call their audience of one, getting in the head of Donald Trump. And that's where the Lincoln Project was really successful.
Oh my gosh, it's amazingly good at that.
Yeah, right, what we were doing, we were able, and by doing that, it allowed us to help expose to the American people who Donald Trump really is. How he thinks, how he responds, we were able to highlight how bad he was because he made himself even worse trying to, you know, as a result of the ads and the attacks that we launched right. on it. So it's like I said, it's a complex playing field, but in the end, and this is the most important part, honestly, I think, Michael, I should have said this at the very beginning, everything that we did was just part of what so many other people started to do. Republican voters against Trump. Some national security folks, Bush 43. I mean, as the campaign went on, more and more people came to the effort, and it became this extraordinary bipartisan national coalition working to defeat Donald Trump on Election Day. And we, the people, were successful.
This effort, born out of the mind and spirit of current and former Republicans. You're still a Republican like myself. We struggle with that because of the level of chaos that currently exists inside the party and the lack of real acknowledgement that there is chaos. It's just this seemingly acceptance, sycophantic acceptance of a man who has no agenda, no plan for the party, has no connection to it. It's not a conservative, not a Republican, not even a good liberal in that sense. So he's nothing in terms of his political identity. What has this election, I think, in your estimation, and certainly the aftermath of it, said to you about the current state of the Republican Party? And here we are now with an incumbent Republican president who refuses to acknowledge he's lost, refuses to do the gracious thing. And you have still senior Republican officials quiet, sheepishly, you know, trying to sneak into their lunch meeting, you know, past the bank of cameras and microphones without saying anything, just feckless in their leadership. This is not a hard one. Yeah, there may have been a few other hard ones, although I wouldn't say that they were, but for them, it may have been politically hard to take a stance or say something on some other issues. But at this point, I mean, I don't understand. So what does it say to you about where the party is at this point?
You know, for the first couple of years of Trump's administration, I would say that my party had, you know, broke my heart. That I was heartbroken to see these leaders that I had previously respected or, you know, just fall in front of this guy. This guy who's nothing more than a 12-year-old schoolyard bully at mm-hmm. his heart. He's a coward. He's weak. He is small-minded. He is intellectually uncurious. But as time moved forward and it became clear that he was all of those things, but also dangerous. And I would suggest in his handling of the pandemic evil, mm-hmm. To continue to see these people become more sycophantic, fall more, you know, to your point, it's creeping, trying to creep past the cameras, whose job it is, by the way, to be there on behalf of the people who elected these folks and ask them those questions and hold them accountable. Now I'm just angry. You know, the heartbreak, I kind of feel like, how stupid was I to think that this party was what I thought it was? Look how stupid I was to have bought into that. And now I'm just angry. What Donald Trump is doing right now is not just ungracious. It's actually dangerous. He is putting us in a position on the world stage that endangers the well-being of our nation. And it's not very often talked about, but what some people may have forgotten is that after 9/11, the 9/11 Commission did, you know, extensive analysis on how these attacks, you know, were able to unfold the way they did, mm-hmm. almost under our nose and, you know, without us noticing it. And one of the little side notes in that very extensive report was that in the 2000 elections, when they were contested in court between Bush v. Gore, you know, the whole thing, we did not, the Bush administration did not get the opportunity to start their transition and get access to information until much later than normal in the process. There was a tremendous amount of confusion and animosity, all these things. And the 9/11 Commission report suggests that in some, to some degree, may have, you know, did contribute to us missing some of the early.
Yeah, it clouded some of the information. Yeah,
exactly. And so for us to sit here now and say, oh, just give Trump time for his feelings to recover and then he'll concede. And let this little, when the little boy feels better and he's done pitching his little fit, then we'll move on. This is about the security of the nation. So Mitch McConnell and Tom Cotton and, you know, the whole crew of them over in the U.S. Senate who are sitting there on their own thumbs just waiting for Trump to decide he's not going to be a pissy little boy anymore.
Excuse the language.
I'm just angry at them. They are putting our nation in danger as well.
Well, you wrote a great piece that came out actually yesterday. And you noted in it, the road ahead is a bumpy one. Trump's inability to acknowledge his loss is feeding dangerous conspiracy theories that undermine democracy and damage free and fair elections. To your point you just made, Republican leaders lacking strength, character, or courage have refused to hold the president in check or speak the truth to the American people. And as always, freedom's enemies around the world are watching. And I think I highlighted that in your piece because I thought it spoke to a myriad of issues that touch on both domestic and international affairs. You've got global leaders now. I mean, the fact, Jennifer, that you had national capital shooting off friggin' fireworks at the loss of Donald Trump. I mean, I don't care what else you say about this election cycle, but when your friends, your allies, are putting up fireworks and they're ringing church bells in Paris at your loss,
right?
that says something that, you know, I think we really do need to pay attention to. And it is amazing to me that Republican leaders, I won't say this because I was about to say it, still don't get it. Here's the, to your point, why I'm angry with you, not with you personally, but I'm agreeing with you that I'm angry. just so everybody's clear what I'm saying here. They do get it, Jennifer. Exactly. They do get it.
Yep.
They know, they get the intel briefs. They see the paperwork coming from Paris and London and Frankfurt and elsewhere that says what these world leaders think. They also see and hear what's going on in the streets across this country. Yes, 70 million people voted for Trump. And I love the spin. It's the most ever by a sitting president who lost an election.
Right, except for his opponent.
Right, who got 75 million Americans to support him. So there is this sense that the leadership is still on this track with Trump. How does that, okay, so when this is over, and it will be over, my take is nothing is going to change because Trump isn't going away. He's a former president with a Twitter account. His son, he's already trying to put his son up in the RNC in some fashion. I love they put out, yes, he put out this tweet yesterday saying that I wholeheartedly support Ronna McDaniel. Yeah, you know why? I mean, this is all a ruse, people. That's because he's pretending like I'm going to get reelected and I'll keep the current chairman in place. And when he's not, guess what's going to happen? It's a free for all. But he's already played his card. He already showed it his hand that his son is sitting there in the wings with his girlfriend.
Which is creepy in and of itself, by the way.
Yeah.
All this, you know, my girl, you know, the nepotism, the weirdness there. God, there's so much in what you just said too, Michael. The first thing, way back to the beginning when you quoted the piece that I wrote, I'm so tired that when you started saying this piece I wrote, I forgot what, I had no idea what you're referencing. I just wrote it 2 days ago.
Right, this was in the Union Leader 2 days ago. It appeared on Veterans Day, which was yesterday.
I got it. And by the way, I think I was right in what I wrote.
I think you were right too, just in case.
You know, if we want to look at this from the perspective of the party and what's happening and what this means for the party, first, to your point, he's acting like he won. He didn't. He lost. On January 20th, Joe Biden's going to be sworn in as president, regardless of all the other nonsense that Trump will engage in between now and then. So to your point, it likely will be a free-for-all. There are going to be multiple people who want to step up and run for that office. Number two, once it is confirmed and certified that Biden won this election, Romney McDaniel may not even run.
Right.
I didn't see a tweet from her saying, I look forward to earning.
She's sitting in the corner rocking back and forth.
Yeah, you know, he just kind of leapfrogged right over it. She probably didn't even know he was going to tweet that.
Of course she did. You know, of course she did.
Think about how tired we are. Poor Ronna. She's probably sleeping under her desk right now. You know, it's such a.
I like her a lot. I remember when she was state party chair. I've always felt bad. And I've told her personally that I never came down hard on her because I knew the job she had to carry because it's tough. It's tough. But anyway, go ahead.
I know what I try. I tried to too, but in the same thing. But the truth is for this past year, I feel like she was, it's hard when you have to choose to stand on principle over politician. And that's what I think Ronna was called to do. And so for, you know, even though she's been there, the whole administration, just this past year, I have had less and less patience. I understand the job she has is hard, but it's her job to do. She asked for that job. And as a party, if we're not putting principle first, Republican principle, founding principles first, then the only possible path is that we end up exactly where we are right now.
Right. No.
So, and that's the, you know, that's the basis of it, the roots of it. And if, you know, people talk about the Republican Party and how will we rebuild and how will they go forward? And in my opinion, the Republican Party has completely squandered any opportunity to continue to be a platform for conservatism or to bring the conservative voice to governance in this country because of their fealty to Donald Trump. And the only way that they get to, that they're going to be able to rebuild credibility, not within the party, because that's such a tiny circle. It's a mistake for the RNC to think that the party is just the 168 that come to their meetings three times a year. Right. The only way they rebuild that credibility is if they are willing to acknowledge and denounce the damage of Donald Trump and the role that they played in it. And as you referenced a minute ago, that's not happening. No. And all these people who want to run for president in 2024, you know, the sitting senators, maybe a couple of governors, I don't know who else is going to come forward, maybe Trump Jr., you know, none of those.
Trump himself.
I think that's kind of a BS thing, but you're right. It could be Trump himself. But anybody who's not willing to have that honest, you know, make that honest acknowledgement of how bad Trump has been for the country is not going to be able to build credibility with that broad coalition you need to win a presidential election.
So let me tell you what is the problem with, I agree with you on the BS notion, although I think it serves the purpose.
It's a fundraising strategy is what
it is. A fundraising strategy to pay off the campaign debt, etc. This is not about a legal defense fund a legal fund for prosecuting this election, folks. So let's understand what we're talking about. This is about Donald Trump paying off campaign debt that he doesn't want to have to carry with him into his private life, because even as a former president, it ain't easy, because he's got to start looking at it, raising money to build a library, right? Which, right. What, and all of that stuff.
That's a whole other podcast. Yeah.
I can't wait to see those books. But here's the problem to your point about who's going to run and what does the party look like in short order. The fact that Trump is putting out on the street, and we understand why he's saying part of what he's saying, at least, is it does freeze the field. It says to me that his presence and command and control over 38-40% of the Republican base is going to be a problem. You know, if these candidates, whomever they happen to be, get out there and they say something he doesn't like, and invariably you're going to get asked as a candidate, so did you support Trump on this? Is this the position of the party and putting kids in cages? Is that the new, do we still see Vladimir Putin as a friend? You know, all these other issues, they're going to be misaligned with Trump. And that's going to be problem number one. Problem number two, I'm already hearing, because of the positions I've taken, I just kind of laugh because it's just hysterical, you know, being told, well, you have no relevance or no say in rebuilding the Republican Party. And of course, my attitude is bite my left butt cheek. You know, you don't get to define what Republicanism is, and you don't get to define conservatism. And I'll be honest with you, I don't think the party should reposition itself as this, you know, absolute conservative party, because you and I know that's not who we have been quite frankly, who we are currently. There is a broad spectrum of philosophical thought that aligns itself along a thread of values and principles that you can put in a quote conservative box. If you want to say, you know, cutting taxes and free trade is a conservative idea, that's fine. Yeah. But when you get into other areas of conversation, Jennifer, you and I know from our work inside and outside the party, you just can't narrowly pigeonhole the work as something that's conservative, because everything is nuanced. The country, the globe, everything is nuanced. And you've got to appreciate the nuance of things in order to be politically relevant to those communities of interest, right? I mean, am I missing something?
And who even agrees on what conservative means anymore?
Exactly. I mean, and who gets to decide what it is?
And who gets to decide what it is? Exactly. Is conservative pepper spraying and, you know, putting, you know, little, you know, bang bombs, whatever, into the crowds of peaceful protesters so that you can hold a Bible upside down in front of a church? Is that conservative?
Right.
You know, so when So you're absolutely right. And I think that this is one of the problems that the Republican Party has right now. And that's what I mean about they've lost their credibility as a platform for any kind of conservative voice or conservatism going forward. I don't know what the answer is for the Republican Party. And there's a big part of me that wants to say, I really don't give a shit either. Am I allowed to say that on your podcast?
Yes, you can. Absolutely. Yes. Should hear me when I get fired up.
they have dug their own hole here, and it's going to be a long climb out. I think it is much more important, think about the Republican Party in my mind, at least, from before I became involved in politics and then mm-hmm. during my time trying to bring a voice or bring some leadership to it, that the Republican Party, I always thought of us as being that we were intended to be an inclusive, organization, an inclusive ideal that. And when we talked about, when I was chairman of the party, I would say, we don't all need to agree on everything. We can, if you're pro-choice, but you identify as a Republican because of this bunch of reasons over here, yay, I want to work with you. And right. And if you're pro-life and you have these reasons for being here, good, let's come together. Like, let's all come together and work together. The party, not just under Trump, it has been a slow progression, but Trump saw this and manipulated it and used it. The party has been on this long path of becoming more divided within itself, in a way that has made it almost impossible for them, for the Republicans to lead, because they don't have a united message. They don't have a shared conviction anymore. And Trump was able to really manipulate that and go divide it even further, because when he figured out that there were these Republicans over here that were never going to be his guys, he made them, they're the bad guys now. The part that had become less inclusive to begin with is even smaller. The base is even more, judgmental, less inclusive. Like he's just, it defies the English language. I can't figure out how to express how insane I think what's happening inside the party really is right now.
A lot of it has to do, and you're absolutely correct in terms of the metamorphosis, the sort of change over time, this gradual degradation of the idea of conservatism. It was not this sort of puritanical litmus test driven, single issue focused mantra. The idea of conservatism is, it in terms of its small c, not the big C, which is what the party applies, but the small c conservatism of Burke and others, founders of this particular philosophy, is about conservation, conserving liberty, conserving justice, protecting those values, those ideas under the Constitution. That's what conservatism was about. That's why I call myself a Lincoln Republican, because Lincoln was all about this idea was everybody is free. Everybody should be free. And yes, he had a tortuous way to get there, but the reality of it is he settled on the ideal of America as outlined in its founding documents, that all men and women are created equal, and that we are endowed with life, liberty, and happiness. That's what conservatism is about, conserving that ideal and allowing you to apply it to your life as you best see fit.
Exactly.
So I don't get to tell Jennifer.
That's it, Michael. That's what we're supposed to be as Republicans. That's it. And so all these modern issues come into play. Of course, society develops over centuries, and I had always thought of Republicanism the same way, that we were trying to preserve the ideal, and that and think about Lincoln. You just said he had like a kind of a torturous way of getting there. Well, he lived in his times, right?
Right.
So he had to, you know, that was, you don't get to, we don't get to choose to live in someone, you know, other
right,
times.
Right.
He had to figure it out from that moment. And if we can, and if all, if we looked at republicanism exactly as you just talked about it, as preserving that ideal right. of equality, freedom, and the pursuit of happiness. I always think that pursuit's an important word there
yep.
because happiness for you is not the same as happiness for
That's
me.
Right.
And,
That's
and
right.
And it's not government's obligation to make you happy, just to allow you the opportunity to right. pursue happiness.
Our
party has absolutely lost that idea, that vision.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Jennifer, we want to get into law. And
oh,
order.
No.
We'll be right back.
Go to break. Tell everybody I am not a lawyer.
She is not a lawyer. We'll be right back with more from Jennifer Horn.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. So we're having this great conversation about the party and where the party is not and what conservatism should mean in the 21st century, as opposed to how it's being applied. One of the interesting aspects of this election cycle that we're now kind of going through is where the president and his legal team have just gone all out. They're throwing legal spaghetti up against the wall and trying to see what sticks. And unfortunately for them, none of it is sticking. I want to share with you, there's this great piece by Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. It was entitled, "Trump Lawyers Suffer Embarrassing Rebukes from Judges Over Voter Fraud Claims." So you've got the Trump campaign out here, folks, as you know, claiming that, you know, maggots are crawling up out of the ground. Frogs and pestilence are about to infest our communities because of the high level of fraud that took place during this election. Well, there was this wonderful exchange in this one court proceeding in which the Trump lawyers had to defend what they put in front of the judge. And so the court said in this particular exchange, quote, "I understand, what you've just said, but I'm asking you a specific question and I'm looking for a specific answer. Are you claiming that there is any fraud in connection with these 592 disputed ballots?" And the attorney for Trump goes, to my knowledge at present, no. Then the judge says, "Are you claiming that there is any undue or improper influence upon the elector with respect to these 592 ballots?" And the lawyer goes, to my knowledge at present, no. So you have this, you have these claims of fraud being brought before these judges who you can tell, and there's more in this particular transcript in which you can tell the judge is, put it politely in legal terms, peaked as hell, that they're going to bring these type of charges without the evidence, supporting right. evidence. You also have law firms now coming under fire for their bringing this litigation. In fact, the Lincoln Project has been out in front in sort of exposing this narrative up front on the record. I talked to a couple of the fellas about my concern because as a lawyer, I was like, yep. Well, people have a choice to represent who they want. But apparently the instinct was right because Jones Day had to respond and say that, they had nothing to do with any of this. It was, we're representing, Trump on or the RNC on other matters, as well as the DNC. It has nothing to do with this. But then you had Snell and Wilmer, who was one of the bigger law firms representing them out in the Arizona matters, actually pull out of their representation. What do you think is going on here, Jennifer, with these law firms, the legal spaghetti being thrown all over the place, and the rebuke by the courts right now, most especially sort of politely but firmly chastising against these types of efforts?
Make sure that, and I get to the end of this question, if I didn't talk about the judges, that Trump underestimating judges that you asked me about, I get back to that. But for the law firms and the folks that are involved in all this, they are bringing cases, they're bringing frivolous cases to the court. They are making accusations that are actually dangerous, that undermine free and fair elections, that undermine democracy. And back to what you and I were saying earlier in our conversation, the world is watching. And it has the way that we conduct ourselves and execute our democracy has a direct impact on countries around the world. It has an impact on our place in the world. And I used to say this all the time when I was chairman that the United States of America needs to remain a beacon of hope for freedom-seeking people everywhere. That is no small thing. That's not just a patriotic, platitude. For us to conduct, for this a sitting US president to make false claims about widespread voter fraud, it's not just like this pathetic, whiny little boy thing that Trump does. It's actually dangerous. So of course, law firms, they have a right to take on any client they want. Right. They have a right to engage in whatever they want. But these particular accusations and these particular lawsuits undermine democracy. And I would think that credible lawyers would not want to be a part of that. And it's not like it's even gray area. As you just read, I think that was a Washington Post story, maybe.
Right, right.
I saw that too. It is clear that the judges are sitting there on the bench saying, wait, what? Excuse me? I've got a backlog of cases back here of people who have actually involved in wrongdoing. What are you asking me to do?
Right. Like,
it's insane, but it's also dangerous. And I would think that serious practitioners in the law would not want to be part of this. I acknowledge their right to be part of it, rah, rah, right, to them. But this, when we talk about the import of the rule of law, that is a big part of what's at play here as well. So I know Kayleigh McEnany getting in front of the cameras the other day with her stack of papers, and everyone keeps asking for evidence, and she comes out, here's 264 pages of evidence.
Right.
What is it? What are you talking about?
What is the evidence?
Give that to your lawyers to put in front of the judge then,
Yeah.
So it's insane. And it goes back to what we've been talking about this entire conversation, just how dangerous Donald Trump's approach to the Oval Office has been. And this is just another case of it.
So you wanted to talk about on the back end.
About judges, absolutely.
Judges, yes.
The big thing for Mitch McConnell and Trump since he became president has been that they're filling all these judgeships across the country. And that's how Mitch McConnell has measured his success. And they've used that to bolster this, this particular, one of the particular cornerstones of the Republican base, that they're filling all these judges.
Right.
And Trump believed as he was doing that he was essentially buying the outcome for anything that he bought
in
front of a judge, right up to the Supreme Court. And what we've seen in previous cases decided by, with Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court, and any of these, the judges are having none of that stuff.
Yeah.
I believe that McConnell and Trump really underestimated the character of judges in America. Like, they're not sitting there going, oh, McConnell got me appointed. I better
rule in his favor.
I better rule in favor of Trump. They take it seriously. They understand the incredibly important role that they play in all of this.
Well, and the thing about that that's also important to understand is, particularly for lower court judges, federal judges, no judge likes to be taken up on appeal, number one. But right. Then when they are taken up on appeal, the last thing they want is to be overruled on right. appeal. And they certainly don't want their case to get before the Supreme Court, and where the Supreme Court goes, what the hell were you doing? No, this is not right. So right. They're very careful. And I've been saying for a long time now, because mm-hmm. I've understood and appreciated the history of Republican appointed federal judges, particularly at the appellate level and the Supreme Court level, that those men and women do come to the table, Jennifer, with a higher degree of professionalism because they know what it means. When you are that close to the Constitution at the Supreme Court level, this is not a hit and run case you're going to be dealing with here. It's not, you know, night court.
I think they have a profound sense of history.
Yeah.
And not just our past history, but they understand that the actions they take are going to be, you know, recorded for history, that they are going to have an impact, that from the position we're in today, that it has an impact going forward. My grandchildren, when they learn history, are going to be living in America that has been impacted by the decisions that are being made today. And I think that the majority of judges have a profound understanding of that. So for Donald Trump, for God's sake, for Donald Trump to think that he was going to like buy judicial decisions, you know, for the infinity, it's just idiocy. It's idiocy. And I'm encouraged, frankly, to see that the judges are conducting themselves in the manner that they are. I think it reaffirms for all of us that, you know, that foundational principle of the law should apply equally to all.
Well, Trump tweeted out shortly after the election that I won this election. I responded to that tweet with SDNY, he's all yours.
Yes, exactly. Don't make me go.
He's all yours.
And you're probably speaking to the heart of what a lot of this is about right there.
Of course. He knows what's awaiting him. He knows what's awaiting him when he becomes a civilian again. And it is, you know, look, it's a bet he's made. He's tried to avoid with some degree, a high degree of success to avoid it. Like all things, you got to account for it. And that's the thing about someone like Trump. He's always managed not to account for it. You know, most of us, no, I won't say most of us, I say all of us would not be able to be allowed to file for bankruptcy five times and still get bank loans.
Right.
You know,
billions of dollars.
Billions of dollars. It just wouldn't happen. And so at some point, you know, we account for that the first time. He's now going to account for it on the back end, but you always account for it. I mean, it is the nature of life. You'll account for it. So before I let you get out of here, I do want to take a moment and focus on the transition and the incoming administration. Joe Biden announced recently Ron Klain as his chief of staff. That sent a very important signal. He's announced his commission on COVID-19 so that they can hit the ground running. But they're being a little bit hamstrung right now because GSA has not recognized the election results and therefore given the keys over to the Biden administration, incoming Biden administration, to do that transition stuff. How do you see that impacting? You referenced it before about the, you know, what the 9/11 Commission says on that, but not so much in, I'm not looking so much in terms of that part of it, but just in terms of how does the Biden campaign navigate these next 70 days or less in order to get his administration stand up, you know, stood up. To hit the ground running, and how the country responds to that.
Sure. First, let's encourage people to focus on what you just said, less than 70 days. As difficult as this president has been, as difficult as we know he's going to be in the next, you know, 60 to 70 days, it's only 60 to 70 days.
Right.
It's about Donald Trump will always be, you know, a burr under the saddle for the American people, but his presidency is this close to being over, and we should all kind of take some relief in that. I think Joe Biden, so far, politically at least, has been exactly right. I think he has hit the right tone, the right message. He was being interviewed yesterday briefly. You know, are you worried? I can't remember the exact question, but you know, are you worried about this with Trump? And no, as he said, he was very laid back. No, it's gonna be resolved. we're moving forward. This is going to be okay. And I think the American people need to hear that. They need to know that they have a leader coming into office who's under control. He's got it under control. He's steady. He's even-handed. Everything's going to be okay. I do worry about the kind of damage that Donald Trump can do in the next 60 to 70 days. You know, the idea of a transition, making sure that the next president has everything he needs to be effective, not just at leading, but at maintaining the security of our country, you know, from day one, is being hamstrung right now. He's not getting those daily briefings that he should be getting at this point. He's not getting access to that information. Who knows what is being shredded as we speak in offices throughout the West Wing? You know, what kind of information is being destroyed? We know that early in this presidency, they were keeping certain records on a different server. Remember the more classified server, records that didn't belong there, conversations with foreign leaders. So I worry about those things, but I think that Joe Biden is, I mean, let's all remember, he was vice president for 8 years. He knows all the tricks. He knows what and who's who and where's where, all that sort of thing. I think Biden, as of right now, pretty much has it under control. And I think that that's a good thing. I love that the first thing he did was announced his COVID commission.
Yeah.
Because his message from the beginning and the reason why, you know, and we didn't even get into this, you know, a significant percentage of Republican, you know, people who voted for Trump in 2016 crossed over and voted for Biden, you know, and I can send you some stats to talk about in the future if you want.
Yeah, that'll be good. Yeah, we can put them up. Yeah.
Everywhere that the Lincoln Project played, we were able to move anywhere from like 5% to, you know, 10% of Republican voters across the line. So, and the reason for that, a big reason for that was the pandemic and Biden's promise and his understanding that we cannot get fully back to work, that we can't get our economy up to speed. We can't fix all the things that we need to fix right now until the pandemic is addressed and under control. And we know it's going to be a tough, you know, it's going to be, you know, a tough teaspoon of medicine to what we're going to have to do as a nation in the short term. So him, I think the fact that he announced that commission first and that he is talking about it as a patriotic duty, a coalition, and a uniting, an issue that should unite us as a nation, I think is a really strong position for him to start from. So I sort of forget the exact question you asked me at this point.
No,
my opinion is I think Joe Biden so far is on the right path. I think he's doing it right.
Well, Jennifer, I appreciate that very much. And I really appreciate you taking time to come on and hang out here at the podcast for a little bit. You like I said at the beginning, you and the Lincoln Project team have done yeoman's work. I know in my communications with, you know, folks who, you know, write over from around the country and who will send a text or a tweet or whatever, they are very much supportive and happy for the work that you guys did. I hear, you know, they saved the country, you know, a lot. So no,
the country saved the country. I'm a big believer. It's we the people. If the Lincoln Project is taking credit for that, somebody should smack us. Can I really quickly, Michael, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I love doing this. Can I invite people to follow me on Twitter?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
It's at NH Jennifer, and we've got to get you back on LPTV really soon.
Yeah, no, I look forward to coming back on LPTV, absolutely. And again, you can follow Jennifer on Twitter at NH Jennifer. She was the former chairwoman of the New Hampshire Republican Party. She is a co-founder of the Lincoln Project. She is the one and only Jennifer Horn. Thanks so much,
Jennifer. Thank you, Michael. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right. So that does it for this week, folks. It's always fun when you guys come to the house and hang out with the guests. We love it. You know, again, don't forget to do the thing I love so much. When you do that download thing, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get the download on. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. And until we get a chance to chat again, be safe, be well. Put the damn mask on. Really? Come on. Stop it. Don't be stupid. Come on. You want a happy Thanksgiving, right? So just do it the right and smart way, and we'll see each other again. Take care, everybody. Until next time, I'm out.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.